hearing him wail away. That's Lee Morgan on trumpet, starting Mogi, with his sidemen Clifford Jordan on tenor sax, Wynton Kelly on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Art Blakey on drums. That's from the album Here's Lee Morgan, recorded on the VJ label in 1960. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And first, I got to explain yesterday. The bottom line is I cannot be trusted to basically close a door, because when I do, as was the case yesterday, to just go down the hallway to the laundry room, I tend to lock myself out of my own house. And it turned into a major production. So that explains yesterday. But today, we are going to be having a really extraordinary discussion. We are picking up on a new chapter on the United States Postal Service. We started that discussion last week when we learned that the congressional committees that have the U.S. Postal Service in the crosshairs, they're looking to do a number of interesting things like reforms and right-sizing and modernizing and all those things that spell major job cuts, consolidation, and as we learned again last week, a real estate boondoggle for people who are well-connected and, in fact, married to folks in Congress who are making decisions about what happens to $80 billion worth of post office real estate that is scheduled to be shut down. Today we're going to be taking a look at African Americans and the U.S. Postal Service. It's a very extraordinary history, really, and I didn't realize it until I got this book, and I was turned on to it, actually, by a listener who recommended that I take a look at it, and it is a remarkable book, and the author will be with us very shortly. But the reason we're discussing this is that there are so many aspects to this struggle to basically support the workers of the U.S. Postal Service. We were told, and it has been said time and again, that contrary to the congressional committees, the U.S. Postal Service is actually not bankrupt. It is not a losing proposition. In fact, it has been quite profitable, except it has been burdened since 2006 with a requirement that pertains uniquely and specifically to the U.S. Postal Service. And that act, the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006, requires the Postal Service to fund, actually to pre-fund, 75 years worth of retirees' health benefits with current payments into that fund, which amounts to about $5.5 billion a year for the next 10 years. No other federal agency is under this burden. And it on the face of it, it sounds unconstitutional. But beyond that, we learned also that if we don't stand up as a community, we too as consumers lose. We lose the vital services that the U.S. Postal Service provides, but immediately we lose the thousands and thousands of people who have made this a calling in life. In my own family, an aunt started her career in the U.S. Postal Service at the turn of the century, and she's long since gone now. But the interesting thing is that her job at the post office, which was to her the greatest thing that ever happened, because it allowed her to buy a brownstone in Brooklyn, in Bedford-Stuyvesant. It allowed her to open up a business. She had a beauty parlor. It allowed her even to start her own little church. And she was very proud and dedicated and worked all of her life, most of her working life. I wouldn't say all of her life, most of her working life in the U.S. Postal Service. The interesting thing is that this particular institution was the place where African Americans directed their energies, and they had a huge struggle, a major, major, major struggle in getting into the U.S. Postal Service. But once they did, and the battle they waged wasn't just to their benefit alone, it actually changed the unionism within the Postal Service, but it changed the labor union movement in the country. And that is why it is important, because African Americans need to understand they have a huge interest in supporting the workers of the U.S. Postal Service, especially now that they're under attack. Because I bet you if you ask your relatives and friends and so forth, you'd find that a lot of them are the beneficiaries of benefits yielded from that struggle. And our guest today is, in fact, the author of the book that will serve as the reference point for our discussion today. It's titled, There's Always Work at the Post Office, African American Postal Workers and the Fight for Jobs, Justice, and Equality. He also is the author of the award-winning book, History of Affirmative Action from 1619 to 2000, or to 2000, if those of you are being very finicky. He is Philip Rubio. And what is interesting about Philip Rubio is that although he is now Associate Professor of History at North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro, he actually is an ex-letter carrier, 20 years worth of service, and here he is today to course us through this remarkable piece of history. And I thank you for being with us today, Philip Rubio.
Thank you. Thank you, Teresa. I'm glad to be on your show. Thank you for that generous introduction.
Well, it's true.
I would just add, by the way, that I did retire early after 20 and a half years at the Postal Service. I worked my first 9 months, however, as a distribution clerk before I switched over to letter carriers. So most of my career was spent as a letter carrier, both in Stowell, starting in Colorado and then finishing in North Carolina, where I live now.
What led you to this particular area of study?
Well, you know, if you ask anybody who turned their dissertation, their PhD dissertation, into a book, this was originally my dissertation at Duke, you know, they'll give you the answer, the typical answer, well, I needed a topic. But, of course, the reason you're in graduate school is because you love to study what you're studying. I loved history, and I also had a passion or curiosity, and I knew I had some background having been, even though I'm not African American, I've worked in post offices in North Carolina where I was really curious about the history of this community within the workplace of my African American coworkers. The fact that I was working here in North Carolina, a state part of the Old South that had segregated post offices, segregated union locals, exclusion of African Americans, and you know all that was broken apart by African American activism, both within and without the post office. So I wanted to, as I was looking for a particular topic that related, you know, to two of my interests in U.S. history, namely African-American history and labor history, I thought, wait a minute, it's right under my nose. That's, you know, that's something that I'm connected to. I just spent the last 20 years working at the post office, working in post offices that sometimes were 50% African-American, and most of them having college degrees, veterans. And I thought, what is the story? What is the story behind that? And looking around and noticing that not many people had written about this story. And I thought, this is it. I've got to plunge in and do this. And it's become it's a continuing passion of mine, exploring this as well as the history of the post office and its unions.
Not only has it been vital to black community development, but black postal worker activism changed the post office and its unions. This is what you wrote in your introduction to the book as a declarative statement, but could you walk us through all the component parts of that statement?
Sure. The post office, first of all, I'm sure many of your listeners will recognize the title, where it comes from, and smile just because it was something that I first heard in Robert Townsend's satire of Hollywood in 1987, Hollywood Shuffle, where the actor playing his grandmother says, there's always work at the post office whenever Robert Townsend's character, Bobby Taylor, protests to her that he's got to take these stereotypical roles and, you know, that Hollywood's offering him. And in fact, you know, in my research, I found that that was a kind of black folk axiom, and that it has a history, but there wasn't always work at the post office. There was work for African-American slaves that they were forced to do before 1802. They weren't postal workers, but 1802, Congress passed a law, and President Jefferson signed it, that banned anyone but, quote-unquote, free white persons from delivering the mail or handling the mail. Why? Why do that? Well, the Haitian Revolution had just taken place. Haiti was about to declare itself the first free black republic, and, you know, it had been a slave revolt. Slave masters were terrified in the South that blacks would get ideas from reading about this and that they would become part of the nation's communications network. That law got abolished the same day the Freedmen's Bureau was adopted in early Reconstruction, March 3rd, 1865. And African Americans start applying for and working at the post office. It pays decent wages, and they can, at the time, they were able to get them as through something called patronage, through political party patronage. Back then, when the Republican Party had a component of at least promoting equality, then African Americans, you know, could get jobs that way. And when they started giving civil service exams in 1883, a lot of them used their background in education, because many of them couldn't get jobs elsewhere. I mean, you had dentists and doctors, lawyers, people with college degrees, taking the postal exam and getting jobs. They were able to make this a niche. They were able to carve out a space in the post office. And it wasn't so much so that the post office was I can't say that it was a welcoming environment, but it was not the hostile, chilly climate that you found in a lot of the private sector jobs, where you had oftentimes white bosses, employees, and even unions telling blacks to stay out or, you know, relegate themselves to lower level and lower wage types of jobs. So this is not to say that there weren't forces within the post office that tried to keep blacks out, or that wanted to compete with them for, or didn't want them competing, you know, for upper level jobs, but that kind of behavior wasn't tolerated the way it was in the private sector. And blacks would also coach each other when the exam time came, you know, in as far as how to score high. The Divine Nine, for instance, you know, black fraternities and sororities in the early part of the 20th century, as well as the National Alliance of Postal Employees, historically black union, they would help people get in. There were family networks that, in fact, today, you'll find in the black community, descendants, like families who, even though they had to take the exam, you can't pass it down the way white construction workers used to pass down jobs, but there was that encouragement. So they did. They made the post office a niche, and this led to being able to, as you said, purchase their own houses, which became quite common, especially in two-parent families where, frequently the mother would be a school teacher and the father would be a postal worker, sending their kids to college, having an impact on the community, being civic-minded, not just being members of the NAACP and other civil rights organizations, which, by the way, many were, but also part of civic organizations like the Elks, the Eastern Star Order. So black community development and activism. Activism, the boundary is pretty thin between the workplace and society. So African Americans who are engaged, let's say, in civil rights activism, and I'm talking about, the last century and a half, would also be doing the same thing within the post office and its unions, campaigning against Jim Crow, exclusion of postal workers from certain crafts, or the relegating of blacks to Jim Crow locals within national postal unions.
So how effective were they in changing the nature of, at that time you couldn't get more segregated, I guess, as a general rule in society, how did they manage to create an environment within the workplace where, to some degree, those very hard lines of demarcation, racial demarcation, were blurred, and people began to see that they had common interests?
That's a very good question. And the way that black postal workers fought for change is like any kind of social movements in this country or anywhere, for that matter. It doesn't follow a straight line. It zigzags. It goes back and forth. So you have black postal workers joining some of the first unions, the National Association of Letter Carriers. They had the local branch president in Memphis was African-American, as was the treasurer, and I'm still doing research, but it's possible that that most, if not all, of that branch was African-American. And you see patterns throughout even the South, even the segregated South, where blacks can make a niche for themselves within unions that don't keep them out. But then there's resistance, okay? There's pushback. You have concerns by white personnel officers that too many blacks are working at the post office. So when Woodrow Wilson comes into office in 1913, one of the first things he does is segregate the federal service and institute something called IDs, application photo IDs. Does this sound familiar? We're looking at the same issue with voter IDs today. They claimed it was to prevent fraud. Does that sound even more chillingly familiar? Well, it was to eliminate the black postal workers who were getting more and more jobs that they didn't want. You know, so you have the percentage of blacks working at the post office dropping from about 10 to about 10% to about 8% nationwide. As Jim Crow sweeps, you know, over the South, you see a hardening of lines, like where even the break room is segregated, where in Washington, D.C., where clerks and in certain units have to work in cages, actual big steel cages to separate them from whites. So you do have, you know, there was a struggle by blacks to get whites on board, and they successfully did it. It's remarkable. The more I studied this, I thought, well, I'm looking at 100 years ago, blacks and their allies in unions like the National Association of Letter Carriers, for instance, which was my old union, they're actually shooting down a recognition of Jim Crow locals, and they do it in these very eloquent speeches, blacks and whites, on convention floor every 2 years until 1941. The Jim Crow proponents got their way all the way up till 1962, when the last of the Jim Crow locals were terminated. So it was a struggle. It was a struggle to get rid of those discriminatory application photo IDs. There's always this, let me just digress for a second. How do you get work at the post office? Well, there's, nowadays, you still have to take an exam after, patronage in 1883 was no longer the main way to get into the post office. But then you still have to get past some unseen personnel officer with this thing called the rule of three. In other words, there can be a batch of applications, and the personnel officer can choose one of those three and drop the other two, and the other two, go to the bottom of the list. So all these, despite all these ways of trying to keep blacks out, blacks were fighting. In 1940, they got President Franklin Roosevelt to eliminate the photo ID, and they had help from the NAACP because the NAACP, saw this as an issue, that was crucial, and the black postal workers shouldn't have to fight this fight on their own. But there are also many black postal workers who are wearing two hats, so to speak. They're NAACP activists.
What would you say was the peak era of black influence within the union, within the postal unions?
Well, let's see. I would say, just off the top of my head, I would have to cheat and say there were two peak eras. One was just before the 1970 nationwide postal wildcat strike, and the other would be right now. I mean, you just had, by 1963, one-fifth of all postal workers were African-American. And with the loosening of gender discrimination, separate registries, job registries, you had more women, especially black women, coming in, as they had come in during World War I and World War II. But during Vietnam, more black women, more young people, and veterans, they became a critical mass at a time when there was a lot of upsurge. So you have unions, you had a lot of wildcat strikes in the 1960s. Workers, not just young workers, but workers were just impatient. They were impatient about their wages, upset with working conditions, and they, with more and more whites being won to the cause of seeing how having discrimination and segregation within the post office and its unions was bad for all. They were also influenced by the civil rights movement, by the Black Power movement, and it was a truly remarkable thing. In fact, 44 years ago this very week, starting yesterday, was when the postal strike happened in New York City, where members of Branch 36 voted to strike for more pay because their pay was so miserable that many of them qualified and were actually drawing food stamps and welfare payments. It spread down the East Coast, out to the Midwest. Not much was happening in the South, but all the way out to the West Coast, over 200,000 workers participated. So there was a crucial African-American component to that strike, but it had been built up over the years with blacks, you know, working with whites, both to improve conditions in the post office and to fight off Jim Crow. And then the other, I would call that one peak. Another peak is today, where African Americans, where it's not incidental, but rather commonplace for African Americans to hold key positions in postal management and the postal unions. And it's distressing to see how many people are laid off, are losing their jobs, or we're losing jobs that are not being replaced. But it's interesting to see that the percentage is still the same, and that there is still activism among African Americans, from what I can tell from my research, from doing oral histories, that keeps pushing unions to be even more inclusive. You probably have the most inclusive and diverse postal service today than you've ever had before. And I think that's directly attributable to African-American activism starting from the end of the Civil War. I mean, besides 21% black, the postal service is about 37% female, 8% Asian American, 8% Hispanic American.
What, therefore, is the stake of the African American community in the current struggle of the U.S. Postal Service?
Well, so many jobs that were, it's not just the easy answer is to say it's not just African Americans and it's not just the Postal Service, but the answer, specifically to what you asked is because of this history that African Americans could depend on work at the post office, whether they had a high school diploma, whether they had an advanced degree, whether they were going to be there for a short time, term or long term. That is disappearing. I mean, it's disappearing for a lot of people who saw that as a step up. When I got hired in 1980, it was for me, like all of my coworkers, good wages based upon that strike, that had won back in 1970. Good benefits for African Americans. One out of five is employed in the public sector, just like in the Postal Service. So what happens when you start seeing public sector jobs going away, as they are generally and specifically in the post office? Well, it's almost like rewinding a movie, rewinding a tape. You have fewer opportunities, and black community development becomes regressive, along with all the other, elements that, like loss of city services and investment in cities. So I think There's that. There is service, which applies to everybody. I think everybody needs to think about what happens if we lose this infrastructure that we've had for 238 years, you know, that links urban and rural, that links every part of this country.
You know, it was just wonderful to me looking at the photographs of postal workers, African-American postal workers, going back to the 1860s. It was just a remarkable thing. And this, your book, is a remarkable contribution to understanding this aspect of history. And I raised that in the introduction to say that very often people, you know, they take things for granted. Let's say, you know, the post office. You just say the post office is this, you know, this amorphous thing out there. But the post office, you actually argue in your book, the post office in so many ways is actually a result of the activism and involvement of their forebears, and people need to honor that. They need to understand that that was an extraordinary contribution, and not only for that generation that struggled, but of course the generational benefits also accrue. So many people today are in a position to do things and are in a position to enjoy a particular kind of life because those who, you know, went before them contributed so much by, you know, waging the struggle, being in the fight.
Right. Right.
I want to ask you about this question of the pre-funding of the health benefits. Could you explain how that actually is held to be constitutional?
Well, I'm not an attorney, so I couldn't comment on the constitutionality of it. I don't think that so I don't know that it's unconstitutional. It seems like if, you know, that someone would have filed a lawsuit on that basis. So I think it's probably we're probably stuck with it on that basis. But it really is an abomination as far as what it has done to a post office that was working fine. I mean, the it's complicated to explain. But the short story is that it was very unnecessary. I mean, you had a post office, which we were just talking about, you know, that, you know, you had just mentioned all the things that, that the post office provides, you know, 6 days a week delivery, internally, you know, jobs that benefited, all the communities that partook in it, especially the African-American community, struggles like seniority, you know, African-Americans, you know, champion those, just so people could have a better life and people would want to stay at the post office. Like, currently you have, like, only a 1% quit rate. It's, you know, you have a dependable, you know, postal worker handling your mail, not somebody who's making minimum wage who, you know, it might not, you know, be as involved in that. But the pre-funding, in case people aren't familiar with it, is, it sounds like you've already talked about it on your show previously.
Yes, we
right?
did. We did.
Okay. So the pre-funding is such an unnecessary penalty. But what it does is that it makes the post office look like a failing institution when it's not. It makes it look like it's near bankruptcy or that we'll have to bail it out. These are all politically charged words that are propaganda. And I try to teach my students at A&T, you know, critical thinking means being able to discern what's factual and what's propaganda. When you make your arguments, you know, we can have debates, but let's have the facts. Well, and the fact in this case is that we had a recession, and we know a lot of the reasons why that recession happened. widespread speculation on Wall Street, two unfunded wars, you know, the Bush-era tax cuts. So suddenly you have a steep decline in the economy, which affected the post office. It's remarkable that the post office actually came through that recession, but the recession hurt it. The use of the internet has hurt it. But despite all that, just operating year to year, the post office does better than break even. And I know that would shock a lot of people. In fact, in this last fiscal quarter, the last 3 months, they showed a profit of $765 million. But with this pre-funding requirement, or I call it a penalty, you have a manufactured crisis, because that law, that Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006, demanded that the Postal Service come up with $5.5 billion annually to pre-fund the health benefits for the retirees decades into the future, as you already stated. And, you know, this is something that's not required for any other agency or private company. Now, many companies and agencies do pre-fund, but short-term, you know, into the future, and not with, you know, such a heavy-handed penalty. The Postal Service was actually doing fine with pay-as-you-go. There was some concern that they hadn't put enough. However, the Postal Service had also been overpaying to its two pension plans, the Civil Service plan and then the Federal Employees Retirement System, so CSRS and FERS. But they couldn't draw from that overpayment. In fact, it was because of that overpayment to the pension that the Congress demanded, you know, to keep the budget neutral, that they invest that money into pre-funding, that they invest operating expenses, into pre-funding retirees' health benefits. So they've got all this money, $50 billion, that they're sitting on, that, waiting for somebody to get sick in 70 years, that they can't do anything with. And so what is it causing them to do? It's causing the postal management to panic, to shutter post offices, to lease them, to sell off historic buildings, to not fill jobs once someone retires, to relocate, to shut a job down and offer relocation to someone who may not be able to. So we've lost 300,000 postal jobs, excuse me, since 2000. Most of that has been through automation, but just in the last few years, we've lost 200,000 jobs, and a lot of that is, you know, shedding jobs, closing post offices early, hiring part-time workers to take the job, the place of full-time workers, you know, at half the pay, but doing really the same amount of work, although without that same level of experience. So you see, when you add all that up, we've created a mess where there didn't have to be one. The post office has always been innovative and, you know, grown with the society. But there are forces that want to declare it bankrupt, that want to privatize it. You know, so that's what we're up against.
You anticipated the question, so you answered it. We're talking with Professor Philip Rubio, who is the author of A History of Affirmative Action, 1619 to 2000, and the book that is a reference point for our discussion today, and I urge you to get it. It's titled, There's Always Work at the Post Office, African American Postal Workers and the Fight for Jobs, Justice, and Equality. Your calls for Professor Rubio at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. How hopeful are you that the current crisis, and I say crisis because of the stresses being exerted on the U.S. postal workers and their unions by these congressional committees and others, how hopeful are you that the message will get across to communities that this is a fight that they need to become involved in?
Well, funny you should ask, because I keep going back and forth between being hopelessly optimistic and just feeling hopeless. And I think I've finally just decided on just being hopeful, because I look for signs of encouragement. The fact that you do have community coalitions, and I see them reported on every time I log in on my computer to this wonderful website called SaveThePostOffice.com, which also features a lot of documents and explanations behind the current manufactured crisis. And when I see the four major postal unions, the letter carriers, the American Postal Workers Union, the National Rural Letter Carriers Association, and the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, coming together for the first time in 3 years, when they had a similar campaign, now calling for preserving and protecting the post office. It always seems like we're such small potatoes compared to politicians and think tanks, corporations who have a vested interest in privatizing the Postal Service. And I try not to sound too much of an advocate when I'm trying to be objective and to be trying to wear my academic hat, but I feel very passionate about this. It's something that people can make a difference on in terms of who we elect and how much pressure people can put collectively on Congress, on the White House, and the Postal Service itself to quit cutting back service and to quit cutting out jobs. And when I say cutting out jobs, I just want to clarify that. When the postal, one of the results of the 1970 nationwide postal wildcat strike was the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970. Bipartisan support, Congress passed it. President Nixon, of all people, enthusiastically signed it in August 12th of 1970, and he said he hoped that it would continue to provide good service and be more efficient, self-supporting. It's been self-supporting ever since 1971, when the U.S. Postal Service came into effect. So you have, you have an organization that rebooted itself in 1971, but strangely enough, now there are sentiments that have power who are trying to privatize it and to try to marginalize it and to promote the idea that somehow it has lost its relevance. And I think that if there's more discussion like you're providing with your radio show today, if there's more, if people are holding politicians more accountable as to how they are going to treat this infrastructure that we have, this communications infrastructure that we depend on, that's also the center of a $1 trillion, 8 million job mailing industry. yeah, then I feel hopeful. I don't know why, but I just I feel like the opponents have had a few years to do their best, and they still have not been able to push the Postal Service out of existence. And going back to your original, questions, excuse me, I just wanted to finish this thought that response to what you were saying. You know, thinking back to how African Americans looked at Jim Crow, in fact, how anybody who hated Jim Crow over the years, for that matter, those who opposed slavery, you know, looked at it like we're just a minority, or the people in power have too much power. You know, but people who hold on to power tend to have too much hubris. They tend to think too much of themselves.
Well, let's take this call from Los Angeles. DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. How are you this morning?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Professor Rubio, it's an honor to talk with you. Actually, I grew up part of my childhood in North Carolina in a small little town, 35 miles from Greensboro, called Eden. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I think at least one of my students is from Eden.
Yeah,
okay.
It's right on the border with Virginia, yeah. So I wanted to just make a couple of comments, and then maybe you can comment on those. I first started hearing this demonization of the post office actually back in the 80s is when I first started hearing this demonization. And, of course, we know that who's behind all this. It's the big companies that want to privatize it, like, and get the business that they're making, like UPS and FedEx. We know who wants to do that, because the post office has always been profitable. And as you said, even with the rise of the internet, with email and all that, I think one of their most profitable years on record was 2006, I believe. So I heard about this Accountability Act. Well, first I wanted to make a point about the demonization. It was very interesting to me when I first started hearing this, some of the same key words that have used to slander black people in general are used with postal employees, like they're lazy, they're slow, they're inefficient, they don't think on their feet, they're, you know, this type of demonization. It was very interesting to me. The second thing I wanted to comment on is this Postal Accountability Act. Now, I talked to people about this. I heard about that in about 2008, and as you said, it was passed in 2006. And I wanted to get to the bottom of why they say the post office is going bankrupt. So I found out this, and I would talk to people about it. And I've known several people over the last few years who have worked at the post office, and even they had no idea about this. So I think that the you can blame the media somewhat, but how do we explain the fact that the people who are actually working at the post office don't even know about these this attempt to take it under?
Thank you, DX.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. It always amazes me, but then I have to remind myself that I was not even fully aware of the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act as I was finishing my dissertation in 2006 and then revising it and turning it into a book. In fact, it's something I became more aware of as I was finishing my book, and then getting calls from the media, and then, you know, calling other people and doing research on my own. This kind of like became a second thread to my research, and just being amazed at how this thing passed and how it impacted. $5.5 billion, are you kidding me, a year for 10 years, and it's, you know, crippling the Postal Service. So where is it in the media? Well, then it occurred to me, okay, they're they're calling people like me. They're calling NALC President Fred Rolando, who wrote a wonderful op-ed piece. I think it was in the New York Times in 2010, I believe. And, you know, the more that people start to speak, just when I tell people individually, they're surprised. And that's a beginning. But I've also noticed in the media that there is more sympathy, that whereas before you would never see the PAEA referenced as an issue, and you would get the idea that, okay, so the ones who want to privatize and bust the post office are winning. Now it's almost, I almost always hear it. That much to me is encouraging. But I think even more needs to be done, so that if it becomes, because you're still fighting, people who are saying, this $5.5 billion penalty, it's rough, but you know, there's still the internet and there's still a bad business model, and we have to completely revamp the postal service and shed jobs and, you know, close post offices. Well, okay, so they acknowledge that it's there, but they're trying to downplay it. So that's part of the struggle to tell truth from lies, you know, fact from propaganda, that, no, this is what's crippling the post office. They would have had $765 million in the last year, and your caller's right. It's parcel products are up, even though, you know, mail volume is down. They're completely self-supporting. No one's going to be bailing them out. People do have to promote what's really going on, and, you know, make demands on Congress to, quit breaking something that has worked for over two centuries.
Well, Professor Rubio, that brings us to the end of our program today. It was indeed very instructive, pardon the pun, but it was. And
thank you.
It is something that I hope that we can engage you again sometime soon to tell us more fully some of the things that the African-American experience within the postal system, and how it actually influenced the labor union movement across the board. That is a remarkable contribution. So thank you so much for being with us today. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Just to remind you, Professor Rubio's book that we were discussing today as a reference point for our discussion was There's Always Work at the Post Office, African American Postal Workers and the Fight for Jobs, Justice, and Equality. He also is the author of an award-winning book as well that should be in your library, A History of Affirmative Action, 1619 to 2000. So, having come to the end of our program, we just did, I suppose, a chapter two. We had some discussions the last time. We talked about the real estate boondoggle that is shaping up and is going to be, because we're going to get Peter Byrne back with us, is going to be the focus of criminal investigation. There was a no-bid contract given to the husband of Ms. Feinstein, this U.S. Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, $80 billion of real estate to dispose of as the sole agent for that, and that's a real problem. But it's not the only problem. We have the matter of jobs that are on the line, major job cuts are coming, and that's the intention of the reformers, and they're making it look palatable by saying it's bipartisan, and we know what that means. They both agree on one thing, and that is to give the jobs to their friends and privatize the service. I hope this program was of use to you today. Let me know. Write me at leadstories@gmail.com, Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lee. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. See you tomorrow. Thanks.